Get road trip ready with a service checkup at your local Chevy dealer. They can save you time and money and get the job done right the first time, worry-free. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for current service specials or to schedule a test drive.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Listening Behind the Curtain, my opportunity to step away from the world of politics and law you watch me cover every day on WGN-TV into the world of my passion, the world of theater and the arts. Today's topic actually is one that I suppose in the day, and maybe even today, might trigger political questions or certainly questions about social issues and stuff. We'll talk about it because the musical that is going on now at the Goodman Theater, one of the best. I'll tell you, Goodman never ceases to amaze me, and long awaited is Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, and it is going on now. It is a musical. Yes, you probably read the book. Yes, you probably saw the movie. But if you haven't seen the musical, you need to do that, and you have till August 11th. Joining me, two of the stars of the show. So glad that you guys could join me. In fact, you are the proper people to have for this interview because, indeed, when it comes to the show, you are connected. And we'll find out about that. So joining me is Tom Hewitt. He plays Jim Williams. This is your first time at the Goodman, Tom. So
yes, it is. Well, yeah, first time.
But listen, I would love to talk some other interview about your work on Broadway, Hadestown, and Chicago, Rocky, and Rocky Horror, which you got a Tony nomination for, your national tours. You're in Town is one of my favorite shows, so I got to tell you, I know people feel differently about that show. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's fun, right? Yeah, it's very cool.
Total fun. I even catch it when little small theaters do it now or whatever.
Yeah.
I will go catch the show, but it's just fantastic. But anyway, Hadestown, I saw you in that. It was just absolutely amazing and continues to be an amazing show.
Beautiful show.
Yeah, and Austin Colby, who plays Danny Hansford, also your Goodman debut, Austin.
That's correct.
And you got in your background Great Gatsby on Broadway. Now, the current Great Gatsby that's on Broadway?
That is correct. I was very fortunate to be allowed a leave of absence to come do Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. And then when we close here next month, I will have 3 days to get to New York and jump right back into the show on Wednesday night. So
I will tell you, I saw Great Gatsby in New York just a couple of nights before the official opening. That's when I was there. And you got screwed in the Tonys. And I'm sorry. That show was stunning. And have you seen it, Tom?
Oh, yes, I have. Stunning, isn't it? That's the word.
The music, the costumes, the sets. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
And, yeah. So, and Jeremy Jordan, I mean, just give my love to everybody in that cast, will you? Because just tell them I was the guy sitting in the third row.
I will. You know, we're pretty proud of the work that we're doing, and to me, that's all that matters.
Yeah, you should be. And I collect movie props and stuff, and theater props, so please steal me something and send it to me.
Okay, sounds good.
Let's talk about Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, guys. I was there opening night. I'm so happy this show has been extended till August 11th. No surprise. It would probably play a lot longer than that if your schedules and the schedule of the theater permitted. What is amazing, I have to assume people don't know. You know, I don't start this assuming everybody has read or seen something. So let me come to you, Tom, first. This is a true story. Your character lived.
Yeah. Yes, true. He's, you know, Jim's no longer with us, but there's still people that knew him. You know, there's people that are very familiar with Jim. I met them a couple of weeks ago. There are some people from Savannah who introduced themselves as friends of Jim Williams.
Can you tell me a little bit about, just for people who don't know the story, this is a true story, true murder mystery, so to speak. Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's a mystery. Maybe it is. But tell me a little bit about the plot.
John Barron's book, Midnight in the Garden of Evil, correct me if I'm wrong, Austin, but he was assigned to go to Savannah to cover this historic preservation. This is Jim Williams, who's largely responsible for restoring a great deal of the historic district of Savannah. And he has this annual party, this Christmas party, and Barrett was assigned as a freelance journalist to go and cover this party, you know, to write an article about it. And he landed in Savannah, found all these outrageous, fun characters, and decided to hang out for a while. And maybe there's a book about this. While he's there, Danny Hansford is killed. He's wild Barrett is there. So suddenly this book takes a turn, and it's an amazing piece of literature. It contains a lot of very interesting characters. There's a lot of different plots. My personal favorite storyline in the book is the trials. Jim went through four trials in his murder, which still, I believe, holds the record for the most trials for a single case in Georgia. So that's kind of the plot line. That's my sort of arc in the story. There are others too. Of course, Ladyship Lee and her journey. Of course, the challenging thing about doing a musical is, you know, in a 2.5-hour musical, there's really only about 90 minutes of storytelling. The rest is, you know, elongated vowels and choreography. So it's hard. It's very difficult and challenging to condense the essence of that book into a 2.5-hour musical and make it a musical. I think our creative team have done just a miraculous job doing that, getting the essence of Savannah and also driving the stories in the show.
Yeah, now, I don't know the reality of whether or not like Broadway is confirmed, but when I watched the show, I went, oh, this is going to Broadway. So, Austin, I hope you're prepared to limit that Great Gatsby contract because, or maybe, you know what, they might do a schedule where you do Gatsby on Tuesdays and Thursdays and anything is possible.
As long as you're there to negotiate that for me, I'll be okay.
I'm a lawyer. I can try and help you. Yeah. Although my own TV contract, you'd probably say no thanks. But anyway, let me talk about your role of Danny Hansford. And by the way, from your first moments on the stage, the audience goes crazy and wild. And I won't say why they do that. You got to come to see the show why they do that. But you both understand what I'm talking about. And but Austin, tell me a little bit about Danny Hansford and why it is that, like, Jim likes him so much, too.
Sure. Danny's an employee of Jim's, working in his antique shop. And there's like a complicated relationship there. And what's really interesting is so much of this story. And in a way, I can say this because my family's from the South, thrives on gossip. And so we learn so much about their relationship in the book through what other characters have to say about their relationship, and specifically about Danny. And so I think, like Tom said, the creatives have done a magnificent job of translating that to theater and allowing for other characters to interpret that. So I hope that it kind of leaves the audience kind of questioning what the relationship is, which then leads to Danny's death. And there's so much mystery there. And with the popularity of true crime and podcasts and stuff in today's listeners and viewers, I think it's really cool what we have here, creating a true crime musical. I mean, there aren't many of those, so it's really fascinating to be a part of.
Absolutely. I've written a bunch of books myself, but the last couple, which are fiction and involve murder and all that kind of stuff, because that's what gets people. In fact, if you guys could turn it into a musical, let's talk about that. It's called Assume Guilt, and that is made for the stage. But anyway, here's the other thing. So, you know, I always ask actors, like, what kind of research do you do to get ready for a role? Which, of course, when it's a fictional thing, you can't. Maybe you can read The Great Gatsby. But here, these people were real. And I'm asking this question to you guys for, and Austin, I'm going to come to you first for this, because I heard you kind of maybe had an interesting experience around Danny's grave.
I did. So I was fortunate enough to do a reading of the show, and then was hired to do a workshop for the show in New York City while the creatives kind of figure out the show. And before the workshop, I was in South Carolina, and the creatives were doing a visit to Savannah and knew I was in South Carolina. So they invited me to drive down to Savannah and see the town. And I quickly said yes. And while I was there, we did a tour, a ghost tour of Bonaventure Cemetery, which was so fascinating. A lot of our show takes place in Bonaventure Cemetery. And they talked about the book, and they talked about Danny, and mentioned that Danny's grave was in a neighboring cemetery. So I went with some of the producers, and at the end of the tour, some of the producers had to go to another meeting, and I had some time to spare. So I said, I'm gonna go see Danny. So we left the tour guide office, and then I went right back in and said, hey, if I wanted to go see Danny, can you give me directions? And the woman said, oh, you want to go see Danny? Okay, you're going to go out this door. You're going to take a right. You're going to take your third left. Then you're going to find letter G. You're going to go halfway down. It's going to be under a magnolia tree. And you're going to look to the third grave. And, like, the directions went on and on and on. And I just kind of was like, oh, okay. All right, I'll do my best. To which she replied, if you're looking for Danny, he'll call to you. And I said, I beg your pardon? And she said, he'll call to you. I was looking for him once and he called to me. And I was like, oh, okay, great. So I followed the directions to the best of my memory. I was driving around and I was like, okay, I'm just gonna be open. I found letter G, and I saw a magnolia tree way in the distance. And so I was like, I bet that's where Danny is. So I got out of the car, started walking, and just was like, I'm going to be open. I don't know really what I believe in terms of spirits or the afterlife, but I'm just going to be open to whatever happens. So I started walking kind of with the purpose towards that magnolia tree. And it's as if my foot got stuck in mud or in the ground as I was walking, and I looked down, and to the right was a tombstone, Danny Hansford.
He stopped you.
I don't know. All I know is that I was stopped by something, whether it was him or not. And I remember standing there and kind of like having chills. And it's so interesting because I remember a breeze and then the sound of a car engine revving. And so much of Danny's depicted love in the book was his black Camaro. And so when I heard that engine revving, like, I looked around and there were no cars anywhere close to me. And so, like, so I just kind of took a second, took a deep breath, and I said, Danny, I'm Austin. I don't know how much of this project I'm going to be a part of, but for as long as I'm a part of it, I will pay the most respect to you and your story. And I think that when you're playing a character who actually lived, regardless of what kind of person they were, because, you know, Danny was kind of a punk and had a bad history, but so much of that comes from probably a place of trauma. And so I just promised that I would play the character with as much empathy as I possibly could, and I challenge myself every day to continue to do that.
That is amazing. Did you tell him it was a musical? Just so he kind of...
I didn't mention that, but Yeah, I wonder what Danny would think of it being.
Yeah, I'm curious what that thing... I have to tell you, I don't know about you, Tom, but hearing that story, I would have been, like, on my way back to the airport and heading out of there with just fear. But
I just got goose flesh from it.
It's just
awesome.
Really... I'm sure you've heard that story from him before, Tom, but what about... Did you visit Jim Williams' grave at all?
No, I did. I was, like many people in the 90s, after reading the book, made the pilgrimage to Savannah, you know. I was not able to, at that time, able to tour Mercer House or spend much time in Savannah. It was just sort of a side trip. But I remember being haunted by it. And now, of course, I'm dying to go back. I know that it's changed enormously, but now, having sort of lived in a way, I'm so looking forward to visiting Savannah.
Very cool. And stop by Danny's grave as well and tell him that Austin's doing a great job.
Absolutely.
And Tom, let me ask you, we don't have Jay with us today, but I mean, I can't do this interview and not talk about the character of the Lady Chablis, which in the book is not that big a deal. And in the movie, as I recall, wasn't that big a deal. But in the musical, Lady Chablis is a big deal. And is brought to, not even brought to life, brought to larger than life by, you know, your Tony Award-winning colleague, Jay. And by the way, when you see Jay, would you tell them don't know if I can do this on a virtual screen. This, you know this book at all, either of you?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So this is an autographed copy of the autobiography of the Lady Chablis called Hiding My Candy, and it is signed. It's signed by the Lady Chablis.
Oh my gosh!
Back in July of '96, I told you I collect things, and so I had to get that once I kind of fell in love with this story and the book and all of that. So, Tom, I'll just ask you: why was this character blown up in the musical because Jay was going to be with you, or would you think no matter what that this character is what the character needs to be for the musical?
Boy, that's a good question, and I hesitate to answer for Jay or for Taylor Mack, our book writer, but I feel that it's largely Taylor Mack's doing. You know, Taylor's sensibilities really lean towards, you know, non-binary presentation. Taylor is a maximalist. You know, he more is more in Taylor Mack's world, and I think that he saw here an opportunity to say the kinds of things that he wants to say with Lady Chablis as a conduit, a vehicle to do that. I don't know if he knew that Jay was attached to it at the time, but oh my God, what a brilliant pairing of those two sensibilities. You know, I know that both Taylor and Jason Robert Brown, our composer, have had intimate conversations with Jay and about Jay's own personal journey and their journey into being who they are, being their authentic selves in their lives, and were inspired by that story. And I don't want to give too much away about the story, but Jay's own personal sensibilities are definitely reflected in the character.
I would guess, and Austin, and by the way, I want to ask this question because I was there opening night. I am coming back, by the way, to see it again. I'm coming with my partner, I got to bring my brother and my sister-in-law, and I always sit front row center, so this time around, I'll give you a big wave at the curtain call, and then happy to come up on stage and take a bow. But anyway, one of the things I noticed on opening night, Austin, and I don't know whether, because it was opening night, so you can tell me, but that Jay has this moment with the audience when it's over, I mean, curtain call time and that end, which is magical. And Tom, on opening night, I watched your face. Austin, I know I'd be talking to you guys eventually, but it was real. There was something about watching you watch Jay. It wasn't like you were just going, oh, there's my you know, co-star here and whatever. It was like, it's as though you two were mesmerized by Jay and the things. And I don't know whether Jay does what they did that night. And I'm not going to get into it, but, you know, with paper and that kind of stuff, you know what I'm talking about. People need to see the show to have that explained. Does that happen every night, Austin? And am I right that when I saw your face is sort of lit up in terms of looking at Jay, that there is an incredible admiration there that isn't just acting?
I don't really have an answer. It's in a way, Jay does have an effect on those surrounding them, and truly has an ability to tap into something. And I don't. Each time it's fresh and new, and I don't have answers, nor do I necessarily need to seek answers, but in a way, it's just, there's so much behind it and so much hope ahead of it that I think that is what every day I witness, and Jay as a leader in this production is so inspiring and like you said, larger than life, that in a way it's the bar is set every single day, and we are happy to stand next to them and rise to the occasion because their performance and this story needs it.
Tom, I want to get your reaction too, because I mean, like I said, I know you're going to Broadway, and I'm sure Jay will be tied to the project when it gets there. But that being said, this whole production, but certainly seeing Jay in this role, is something that people who love theater do not want to miss.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's really a unique thing. The event at the end of the show, it's totally unique. I've never had an experience like that before. It's genuine every time, every night, and what Jay puts into what he says is fairly meaningful. It's easy to be emotional at the end because it's so genuine and so meaningful to me personally.
And let me, Tom, I'll stay with you. Let's talk about the music. because, and I don't know why, it was, to me, the music, much of this music was Haiti-town-ish to me, a little Haiti-town-ish in its tenor and its tone. I don't know why I feel that way, but I just did, it's very powerful music, whatever, and I'm Haiti-town is something that will always stay with me. I've seen that a million times, almost invested in it, actually, but I invested in Broadway Bubbies instead, so but just tells you my luck. Tom, talk to me about, I want both of you to talk about the music in this show. It helps propel the story, but it goes beyond the story because there's messages involved. I just think it's amazing music.
It's amazing. This is the guy that wrote Parade, you know? He wrote Bridges of Madison County. Like, his range is just... And Honeymoon in Vegas. He writes... There are so many different styles of music in the show, and I think I hear the Hades, what you're talking about, the Hadestown sensibility too. The arrangements, Doug Besterman's arrangements, are also awesome, and we have three trombones. There's out of 12, there's three, so that sort of southern jazzy New Orleansy thing vibe can really come out with those trombones. It's challenging music. It's so wonderful, and I have like the best lyric. It's ridiculous. The opening number is the tune is just fantastic. Oh. Lyrics are ideal. They're just glorious, and it's so fun to be up there,
and so fun to be down in the audience and watching you. And Austin, yeah. Which has better music, Austin? Great Gatsby or Midnight in the? I'm kidding. I'm not asking that question.
Thank you.
But your thoughts about that? I'm sure you agree with Tom. But it's just stunning music. The set is stunning. The costumes. I walked out just shaking my head, and immediately got tickets to come back.
Awesome. I love that. That's so great. Yeah, I heard Jason did an interview a while ago that talked about his process of selecting or accepting a job, and the first thing he looks for is, does the story sing? And he felt that way with this story, and I agree. And his ability to create, take the characters and assign them a certain style or a certain melody, and those themes that come, that repeat throughout the story, it's so artistic and so beautifully done, kind of like seamlessly done too. Like there's an ease at which it happens. I would only I would love to peer into his mind as he creates and stuff. And we saw that a little bit. There was a beautiful day where they were looking for a musical moment at the end of Act Two. Which is now Jay, Ladyship Lee's song, More Room. And there was a day before Jay had even prepared it, but we did a run in the studio, and we were running the show, and we took a pause, and Jason got behind the piano and played and sang the song, and it's going to be a memory that I hold on close to for the rest of my career. And those are like... those are the pinch me moments, and that was in one small room, and only a handful of us got to witness it, and it's really magical. And then the way Jay then took that song and ran with it and owned it is that's what I love about what we do.
I'm so glad, you know, and I also do a television version called Backstage. And but anyway, so in that show, I've had moments where I got to sit with Stephen Schwartz, where he played a song for me, and Richard Sherman, who just passed away and did Disney stuff. I mean, you're right. Those are moments when you go, this is just take to the grave stuff. This is stuff that, you know, has impacted me in such a huge way. I do want to talk to you about being at the Goodman. You know, look, we have our Broadway playhouses here. You know, I keep the Schubert. It'll always be the Schubert to me. But anyway, with the Cadillac and the Niederlander and these, and they're fantastic. Because this is your Goodman debuts, I know you're also very aware of Steppenwolf, Goodman. To me, those are on the par theaters. Which, by the way, if you've not seen Laurie Metcalf's show at the Steppenwolf right now,
I hear it's amazing.
Yeah,
it is unbelievable. And if you don't get a chance, the podcast of mine that's airing right now is Laurie, Joe Mantello, and the cast. So just go to WGN Radio, look at that podcast. It's soaring right now, and we don't talk about the Connors at all. So it's definitely an interview that you want to watch. That's how I got her. I said, I swear I'm not going to ask you about Roseanne. But anyway, going to the Goodman. I mean, I'm guessing it's this project that brought you here, but. But Tom, what did you know about the Goodman? I mean, are you saying, wow, I'm going to the Goodman? Or are you like, oh, I don't care where I go. I'm just going to go with Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
No, I'm thrilled to go to the Goodman. You know, it's got, it's one of the best of the best. You know, it's really a very reputable theater. They have, the crew is magnificent. We are so lucky to have this sort of in-house crew that are just on the ball, really invested in the show. Some of the best dressers I've ever worked with, and I have a very close relationship with my dresser, with a lot of changes, and some of them are very quick. And it's really a fun, it's a really kind of a fun vibe backstage. The support we've gotten from the Goodman from day one has just been extraordinary. I'm so proud to be there and to be there with this show and to you know, let the Goodman support us.
I have this theory, Tom, and I'll come to you, Austin, but I have this theory that you might even be better treated. I don't know what I mean by that phrase, but better treated like in Broadway houses. In other words, just the kind of attention given to you, the respect that would ever given to you, might be a step what you might get in a Broadway house, maybe because it's just typical in New York. I don't know.
I agree. Plus, you know, there's a costume shop and scene shop in the theater. So, you know, you don't have to, like, travel to the tailor for a fitting. You know, it's all right there. So that makes it easy and convenient and efficient, too.
I love Austin, what's your just reaction of being in the Goodman? I'm sure Goodman people are watching this, so be careful what you say. No, I'm kidding. I know what you're going to say is good.
Well, it's like Tom said, it's very reputable. I had a friend who found out I was doing a show at the Goodman, and they're also an actor, and they said, "Oh wow, you're working at the Goodman? You must be a really good actor, because they put out really, really great work." And now, having worked there, it's just such a loving, hospitable, safe environment to put on really good work, and everybody's motivated to do that. I think they just do a really wonderful job, and it's such a community. And specifically with the show we're telling, community is necessary to tell it.
They've always taken risks. You know, the show War Paint, right? Patti LuPone. And that started here, went to Broadway. Tommy, which is, while it's wrapping a run on Broadway, also a phenomenal show that was here. You can check out my interview with that cast as well. And The Outsiders was to have started here, and COVID got in the way, but that would have been the pre-Broadway start right here. There's something about, Tom, I'm curious, because again, so much Broadway work in your background and travel. Were you here for Finding Neverland?
I was.
Yeah.
Yes.
I thought so. Yeah.
I was here for Finding Neverland.
What is there? Something about Chicago audiences. I mean, so many producers want to start, you know, talk to Jerry Mitchell and ask about starting a show or having its pre-Broadway run here. Everything he does is here, but he's not the only one. What is it about, do you think, Chicago audiences? I mean, versus New York Broadway, people, they say we're more sophisticated. Just, you learn so much from a Chicago audience.
Yes, we are. Why would we characterize a broad characterization of Chicago audiences as a smart and supportive? You know, they
love theater.
Really, really appreciate theater, and they're smart about it, I think. You know what I mean? It's just a delight. Every time I played here, it's like, oh, these are theater people. You know, it's delightful. I love this.
My theory has always been, in New York, I love New York, but in New York, it's like, you have a lot of tourists. It's a tourist industry there is theater. But in Chicago, we go because we live here. Yeah, we go because we love it. Yeah. And Austin, who has better audiences, The Great Gatsby? No, I'm kidding. What is your thought about your experience with Chicago? I'm just kind of promoting you in The Great Gatsby, too, for when you get back. What is your reaction to the Chicago audience as you're before us every night? The night I was there, man, we went bananas at the end of this show. And during the show, by the way. There are ovations during this show.
Oh, my goodness. I remember specifically opening night thinking backstage, I personally felt like we were overwhelmed with the response, because sometimes we didn't know what to do with it, especially when things were like timed out with music. But we wanted the audience to show their appreciation enough, so we were trying to measure that. I think that, you know, that, like I said, hospitality, that Midwestern welcoming home vibe is truly what you get, but with such a smart audience. I mean, I think that the feedback that we've been given has been positive, yet holding us accountable, which is, in my opinion, the best the best feedback we can get.
And I'm so glad, I assume the conductor will get some credit for this, the conductor allows the audience to respond as it does, because I've never forgiven, in Wicked, I've never forgiven the fact that Idina Menzel and everybody who does it, after they do Defying Gravity to end Act 1, curtain down, lights off, and you don't get to give her that ovation that you want to give that performance. And same thing with Jennifer Holliday back in Dreamgirls, right? With I'm Telling You I'm Not Going, and, you know, boom, Act 2, boom, gun, you're not getting your ovation. It robs us. And you get to get those ovations here, which is great.
What's nice, though, is they're kind of leaving you wanting more, which in a way is get you to come back for Act 2, which I personally kind of love. Sometimes not offering an audience the chance to applaud, it can impact a later part of the story, which I think is kind of artistic in its own self.
I don't disagree, but you're talking to a guy that owns Lin-Manuel Miranda's original Hamilton boots, so I want that moment and the opportunity to do it. Not to mention Elphaba's makeup. I can go on and on with the Broadway stuff. You need to steal me something off this stage, too, while you're here.
Okay, sounds good.
Tom, tough question, unfair question. I know you've read the book because you talked about that. What does the musical get right that the book might have missed? Or what does the musical get right?
What does the musical get right? Well, I think the musical gets right a kind of sensibility about Savannah itself, and in particular the Bonaventure Cemetery. I think there's a vibe that's really, really interesting about it. You know, here's the thing, though. There's a lot of material about these people. You know, they're actual people, and there's a lot of facts. There's a lot of photographs. I've listened to recordings of Jim Williams' voice. I've heard him speak. The thing about investing in the book and into the research is that you have to let so much of it go. You know, all this stuff is very interesting to learn about, but I can't do that, Jim Williams. I can't, you know, my Jim Williams bursts into song. I am considerably older than Jim was at the time, so I take what I can get, and I take what's useful, and I also have to, you know, let it go. That's some of the things that you can't hold that stuff precious. So that can be a challenge sometimes.
Austin, sometimes I'll ask, when people play fictional characters, of course, you have to create the character, right? When you play a real character, historical character, then you have something to go by, like doing a one-man show of LBJ. I talked to Larry Luckenbill not long ago who put that together. It's one thing to have a live character. You here have a character who was real, a person who was real in Danny, but you don't know Danny. No, you know, we know he wasn't a star at the time, but you did go to his grave and had that experience. I'm sort of curious, did that experience, as you began to learn the role, do the role, does that experience stick with you? Did it inform how you want to play the role? Or I guess I'm saying, is the Danny maybe still with you in that way? Or am I getting too weird?
Danny's certainly with me, but what is with me the most is having done research and learning about his childhood and some of the trauma he experienced with his family and you know, his father leaving and his mother and his childhood in a way just kind of more and more fueled my empathy for him. And while I like I said, so much of the character is learned through what other people have to say about him, and I think that that can influence how I'm portraying this character, because I think that it seems like Danny just never was going to be good enough, and I think in that's something that all of us can kind of relate to in life, that feeling of low sense of worth, I think, is completely relatable. And so much of, and you know, you can, we don't know enough about his murder and how it actually went down.
And I also say, and I also think you, and I think you intentionally, or you're directed to create this ambiguity. I walked out having a debate with my partner and people we were with about who exactly is Danny? What? And I'm not giving things away. I want people to enjoy the show. Was he this or was he that? Was it, you know? And in the end, we don't know. I'm sort of curious, in your mind, Austin, can you answer that? I'm not going to ask you, but can you answer that question? Well, let me tell you exactly who Danny was. Or are you two saying, not sure?
I think the only thing I'm sure about is keeping Danny's best interest in mind, but I think it's important in terms of the story that we're telling to maintain that ambiguity, for sure.
All right, it's cool. Tom, by the way, I've been doing the show as like it stars three people. Give me a comment about this in very large and very incredible ensemble cast you work with. Amazing.
They are amazing from the very beginning. The rehearsal room was one of the most extraordinary rooms I've been in. You know, it was always so positive. And people knew that we had something special, and everybody was very, very focused and in a very positive way to do the best that they could do. You know, music, new musicals are hard, material is constantly changing, new pages, new choreography, songs are cut, songs are added. And Rob Ashford really made a beautiful, productive, focused, joyful room, and it was an honor to be in there with that remarkable company of people. Our ensemble is, they're just remarkable. They're just the best of the best, and it's been a joy.
I'm glad you mentioned Rob Ashford too, because I should have done that, because an amazing talent.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And Austin, you as well, having fun with that ensemble cast?
Absolutely. I mean, they're so much a part of telling this story, and I think they take that responsibility to heart, for sure.
Well, this is a show truly not to be missed. I like a lot of shows, but I don't get as excited about a lot of shows as I do for this one. Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. It's a world premiere, only through August 11th. GoodmanTheater.org, theater spelled the proper British way, T-R-E, GoodmanTheater.org is where you can get tickets. Tom, Austin, just break legs every night. You guys are fantastic. I will get to Broadway and see you when you're there. Austin, I'll try and pick a night when you're not in Great Gatsby and you're doing Midnight as you're going back and forth. I appreciate it. Thank you. Appreciate you much.
Thank you.
Right.